When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you know, Duncan, sometimes I feel that this podcast is like operating on a secret mission deep behind enemy lines.
Do you?
I do. What would really help me is if the RAF would fly a plane overhead and drop a like, subscribe and five-star review ahead of my position.
That would make our mission so much easier.
It really would.
Welcome to A Pod Too Far, the place where going commando still means parachuting behind enemy lines. Today we're joining Yugoslavian partisans as we set out to kill a traitor and destroy a bridge. That's right, it's Force 10 from Navarone. I'm Rob Hutton, and I'm nursing a leg injury that makes me quite unsuitable for this podcast. Climbing into my Lancaster just before takeoff is a man on the run for unspecified crimes who will, before the episode is out, have buried a corpse in some woods. Hello, Duncan Weldon.
Hello, Rob.
Force 10 from Navarone. Any memories do you think you...
Right, okay. When we decided to do this, I thought I'd seen it.
Right.
I then watched it. I hadn't seen it. And I'm going to be honest, I sort of wished I still hadn't seen it.
We will come back to that. I think this is the first war film I ever saw.
And you watched more to the extent you've done a big
Well,
podcast.
I think if you were sort of six...
Yeah, okay.
This was pretty good. And I think at the point that I saw it, I probably hadn't seen Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I had, I certainly didn't recognize Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
The biggest bad effect that this film had on me as a child is, well, first of all, only having seen the word written down, because it's only said at the start of the film, and as previously discussed, we never ever watched the start of these films. We would turn them on and they would be going and we'd be trying to work out what the plot was. I had no idea how Navarone was pronounced, mm-hmm. and I just assumed it was Navarone.
Mm-hmm.
And for years after that, I assumed that the guns of Navarone was Navarone, Force 10 from Navarone. So that's part of it. The other problem is that this fixed in my mind who Mallory was as sort of Robert Shaw, as a bluff, posh Englishman.
Yeah.
And so when I, in fact, then watched The Guns of Navarone,
yes.
Gregory Peck was a huge disappointment.
Yes.
Which is wrong.
Yeah, it is wrong. It is wrong.
Clearly, The Guns of Navarone
I'm really glad you've recanted this view subsequently.
Clearly, The Guns of Navarone is a better film on every measure.
Yeah.
You know, no offence to Robert Shaw, but he not necessarily a leading man in the way that Gregory Peck was just clearly a leading man. Yes, I mean, they don't even really bother trying to make this into a...
I have so many questions about this film. I'm going to start off, how on earth did this come about? Because, you know, you've got Guns of Navarone, which we've talked about, which is, what, 16, 17 years before?
Yeah, yes, early 60s.
Yeah.
So it's based on Alistair MacLean novel.
Yeah.
Alistair MacLean writes The Guns of Navarone, made into a very successful film. Alistair MacLean writes Force 10 from Navarone because he's a man who can sort of see where the money is.
Yeah.
And this
is in the 60s.
And this is in the 60s.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's pretty immediately optioned.
Yeah.
Force 10 from Navarone, the book, starts the moment that The Guns of Navarone ends.
Okay.
I mean, it actually, as this film does, it starts with them on a Royal Navy ship, I think.
Yeah.
This then sort of jumps back to England for some reason.
Yeah.
So the timing of this is Guns of Navarone, we think, is during the Peloponnesian campaign, which is late 1943.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they've gone back to England.
Yeah.
Where it's still summer 1943.
Yeah.
And some time has passed because Miller has left the army and joined, you know, and become a civilian. And Mallory, who is obviously a spy, is for some reason now, you know, doing food orders at a commando training camp.
Yeah.
I mean, none of this makes sense.
No.
So, right.
But I reckon you can get away with none of this making sense in narrative terms, because this film is coming out in, what, 1978?
Mm.
The previous film was 17 years beforehand, and this is a time before easily available home entertainment.
No,
presumably very few people will have had fresh in their mind the first one when they went to see the sequel.
Yeah, you basically just put these two guys on the boat, and you hope that people think that they will think, "Gosh, I'd forgotten that Robert Shaw was in the first one."
Yeah,
I think yes. I mean, so the novel has the same basic sort of setup. Yeah. Except, as I say, they're taken off this Royal Navy ship almost immediately and sort of told they get sent to Italy, and then they're told they have to go to Yugoslavia to kill the chap who betrayed them in the first one, who I have to admit I spent some time trying to think, who the hell? I still don't know. I've done quite a lot of research, and I still don't know who it is. Anyway, him. Yeah. They're supposed to be killing him.
Now, he's the MacGuffin which gets him into Yugoslavia.
We only watched... I've watched Guns of Navarone, 6 months ago or something? I and I still can't remember.
So imagine it had been 18 years.
Yes, I mean, right. That's how you get away with it. Basically, what you've got here is a lot of people who have been in very successful films in the last 2 years. So Robert Shaw is coming off Jaws. Speaking of Jaws, Richard Kiel, who plays Jaws in The Spy Who Loved Me, is coming off the back of The Spy Who Loved Me. And joining him from The Spy Who Loved Me is Barbara Bach. And Carl Weathers, is coming from Rocky. Edward Fox is coming from The Day of the Jackal. Harrison Ford.
Coming straight from Star Wars?
Far the most interesting bit of casting in this is coming straight from Star Wars, and is
I want to stop. I want to stop there because I've got two questions.
Only two.
Firstly, what on earth is Harrison Ford doing in this movie as an actor? And secondly, what on earth is the point of Harrison Ford's character's role in this plot, as there appears to be precisely none?
Why don't I read you some quotes?
Go for it.
For a relatively minor work that many people might not know existed, Harrison Ford has talked quite a lot about Force 10 from Navarone, possibly just trying to work through this in some kind of therapy. So things that Harrison Ford has said about why he made this film.
Yeah.
To take advantage of the chance to work. I did it for the money.
Oh, great. Inspiring stuff.
He said about it. He said, "I was lost because I didn't know what the story was about. I didn't have anything to act. There was no reason for my character being there."
Oh, I'm pleased we agree on that.
Yeah. "I had no part of the story that was important to tell. I had a hard time taking the stage with the bull I was supposed to be doing." And it does. It just catches him. I mean, it just catches him at the moment. I've just got his IMDb listing up here. And it's very, very hard, I think, for us to think of a pre-1980 Harrison Ford. But the Star Wars does not, it seems, instantly make Harrison Ford into a star. Mm-hmm. Star Wars sort of instantly raises the level of, you know, he's been doing TV stuff before then.
And a lot of carpentry, I
guess. And a lot of carpentry.
Yeah.
And Star Wars gets him to you can be a supporting actor in a Robert Shaw film level. Other films he makes in 1977, I've known nothing about this film called Heroes that stars Henry Winkler, the Fonz, but I'm going to read you the IMDb summary.
Go on.
A Vietnam veteran suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder breaks out of a VA hospital and goes on a road trip with a sympathetic traveller to start a worm farm in California.
Sounds like an absolute classic.
It does. Amazingly. And Harrison Ford is a supporting cast in that. Yeah. He's not even the worm farm guy. He's a worm farm guy. Forced in from Navarone. He also, at this point, makes a film called Hanover Street, about which I can tell you absolutely nothing. He makes Apocalypse Now.
Okay.
Do you remember who he is in Apocalypse Now?
I don't, actually.
Right, so he plays a nervous colonel who is briefing Martin Sheen at the start.
And does he?
He does, and I happen to know because reading about Apocalypse Now recently, there's a bit. He's in the first 10 minutes, and he's so, the character he plays is so nervous that he drops the briefing papers.
Yeah.
Apparently that was Harrison Ford for real, just really, really nervous on set, dropping the briefing papers, and they decide to roll with it because it works. He's not a star, and he obviously doesn't feel like a star.
No, but then it's a very quick turnaround.
Right. Let's talk about Harrison Ford from 1980.
Yeah.
1980, The Empire Strikes Back. 1981, Raiders of the Lost Ark. 1982, Blade Runner. Return of the Jedi. Temple of Doom. Witness. Mosquito Coast. Frantic. Working Girl. Last Crusade. presumed innocent. That is his 1980s.
Yeah.
1991 regarding Henry, and his run's over
at that point.
I mean, there are moments
so
after that.
This is sort of Harrison Ford on the cusp.
Yeah, it's Harrison Ford on the cusp, and he doesn't know he's on the cusp.
No, but that's Harrison Ford the actor. I go back to Harrison Ford the actor being right about his character, though, who I just watched the film thinking, what on earth is this character adding to anything?
There's some kind of arithmetic going on here that is, how can we make a successful war movie? Get her from the Bond film.
Yeah.
Get him from the shark film.
Yeah.
Get him from the spaceship film.
Yeah. Put them on the Lancaster bomber and see what happens.
Yeah. I think readers may be sensing that neither of us thinks this is in anyone's top 100 anythings. This feels to me, as I was thinking about this yesterday, I got an email telling me that the Blue Beetle is now available for streaming. And I thought, oh, right. Because I haven't seen the Blue Beetle in cinemas, can't tell you anything about it. We have reached the point of superhero movies.
Yes, where
they're just making stuff on the basis that it's a superhero movie, maybe somebody will go to see it. And I feel like 1978
is
that moment.
Commando film.
That moment in Commando films is just, oh, I don't know. Yeah. What have you got? That's and this sort of, oh, well, we'll drop them in and there'll be some double crossing is sort of a version of, well, he's going to go into a multiverse where an alternate reality where he's going to meet himself and he's going to try and save his mother and all of that nonsense.
It all feels very by the numbers, this plot.
It does.
Well.
It really does.
It's just like all of these different aspects of sort of... It's sort of a subgenre of war films. It's sort of the commando film and the commando mission. And this is just a load of tropes from different commando movies mashed up together, set in Yugoslavia, which is slightly different. What is objectively a very good cast? Just they're not given anything to work with.
Would you like to know what Robert Shaw said about it?
Oh, God.
he said while making it, he said, I have it in mind to stop making these big budget extravaganzas, to change my pattern of life. I wanted to prove, I think, that I could be an international movie star. Now that I've done it, I see the valuelessness of it.
He said that while they were making it?
Yeah.
Tremendous.
And then he died. I mean, I thought it's sad.
You're
but
not claiming Force 10 from Navarone.
I don't think Force 10 from Navarone, I finished him off. But equally, it is sort of, he doesn't know why he's in it.
No.
It's not clear that anyone involved knows why they're... I mean, it's directed by Guy Hamilton, who we've done The Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
Which is a big... But again, you sort of feel like there's lots of people here who are sort of taking a paycheck.
I think that's...
Helpfully, though, another reason why they may have made it is set in Yugoslavia, and you can film in Yugoslavia.
They've got the right kit lying around
They've got kit lying around.
Yeah.
I think that nerdier podcasts than this would dispute whether or not they've got the right kit.
Yeah.
But Tito provides 2,000 soldiers.
Good for him.
As extras. And some T-34 tanks.
Nice.
Which we are offered as panzers. I mean, I am not a tank nerd.
No,
but even I looked at those and thought, that's not a panzer.
I suppose, actually, I can see why Tito thought this was a fine...
I mean the partisans come out of it pretty well. More or less hits the buttons he wants to hit. There are bad Yugoslavs, but I don't think he's got a problem with the idea that they were.
No. Successful partisan leader for all the right kind of partisan.
Yeah. And actually, so it's a battle that he is sort of supposed to have fought in.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me.
I said beforehand that at this point I'm just going to hand over to you and you're going to give us a quick 10 minutes on the Battle of Eterna.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just good. You go back to the partisan war in Yugoslavia. It's one of the more active ones. The Yugoslav partisans. So, okay, when we in Britain think about sort of resistance in occupied Europe, we tend to think of the French resistance, and sometimes it gets a bit coloured by Allo Allo and Secret Army and all of this. Yeah. But, the French resistance, you know, that's the odd bit of sabotaging railway lines or planting a bomb or assassinating the odd officer or whatever. The partisans in Yugoslavia are much closer to the partisan war in the Soviet Union in that they are, you know, operating in units and fighting the German army in pitched battles.
In actual
battles. So, you know, so it's a very different type of resistance. The politics of it in Yugoslavia are very, very complicated. You've got, you know, communist partisans, you've got royalist partisans, you've got various different sort of ethnic groupings of partisans. It's very, very messy. And the politics are even messier because, you know, they're very close to the Western allies who are fighting their way up through Italy. So they're getting British and American support, but they're also getting Soviet support. And Tito actually is very good at playing off these different sides of support to get what he wants. But it's a messy situation, which I think actually the film does bring out.
Yes. And the Yugoslav campaign is one of these ones where I couldn't tell you a lot about it, but you do keep coming across famous people who are there or who spend some time
Evelyn,
there.
Evelyn Waugh was there at the end of the war. And, you know, if you read Sword of Honor, Sword of Honor is a fantastic trilogy of books. I mean, absolutely fantastic. But, you know, but it's all sort of coloured by his experiences in Yugoslavia at the end of the war, then straight afterwards.
Yeah.
And, you know, watching the communist take off. You know, even more with many things. Not very keen on communism would be one of them. You know, he thinks what happened in Yugoslavia after the war and this takeover by the communists was disgraceful. And, you know, much condemnation from him of his part in it. You know, he found himself constrained into supporting what he thought was the wrong kind of partisan.
From the British allied point of view, anything that is tying down German forces into some kind of unpleasant war of attrition in a way that actually the second half of the 20th century, we will see lots of these. So you have a large army and tanks and you wish to come and fight in our woods.
Yes, yes.
That's, you know, those kinds of battles.
Yes.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see how that works out. This is that kind of, you can see what's in it for us.
Yeah.
Let's go to the after-action report. Quick, Dad, they're on the cable car. Are there any moments at all, Duncan, in which you would like to be called in?
I honestly, probably not. I mean, there are some decent enough action sequences, but the problem is once I'd seen them, I'd then feel sort of, you know, burdened to stay and watch the rest of the film. I mean, if you could make me like a YouTube clips video of the best scenes, I could name some scenes I'd like in that. But
I mean, it actually made me think of the modern Mission Impossible films. Those are made much more expensively and much more beautifully, but that essentially someone has sort of got, well, we'll have a car chase through a Central European city and we'll have Tom Cruise dangle off something.
Yeah,
and,
same with many of the modern Bonds as well. You've got your touchstones you need to hit.
Yeah. So can somebody write a linking scene to explain how they get from here to there?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's, not very much money is spent on that, that scene.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much of this that makes no sense. Why are they stealing a Lancaster?
Even the
offered explanation makes a sense. You're stealing a Lancaster, and Harrison Ford's going to fly it, but you're not going to bother to have anyone man the guns.
No, I'm just going to
Because
flying over that part of Europe in a British bomber is fine at this time.
Why is Carl Weathers under arrest? Do we ever establish what he's supposed to have done?
We don't.
Right,
don't.
You know, that's fine. He's a medic and also a knife thrower.
He must have done something really bad.
Yeah.
Because he'd rather get on this, you know, go with these guys than stay and face the heat. So
he's not being arrested for being off base an hour late, is he?
No, right? It's probably related to the knife throwing. Bad guy.
It also feels, the bit where Robert Shaw is trying to persuade the German that actually they're deserters. I mean, again, that feels incredibly recognisably Alistair MacLean, but you sort of feel like you've seen it done better in Where Eagles Dare.
Yeah, I honestly don't think you got that many deserters from the Allies to the Germans at this point in the war.
There are other places you might go and hide out.
We'd like to join up with you guys who are so obviously losing because there'll be no repercussions for us at some point down the line. Germans, right to be suspicious.
She's not so dumb. There is one woman in this film, Barbara Bach. Shall we combine this with the Dan Busters Dog Award for problematic moments?
I feel that's sensible.
I mentioned to somebody who I suppose is about 15 years older than me that we were doing this film, and he reacted with a frankly surprising level of enthusiasm. And then I remembered that he would have been about 18 when it came out, 17. Yeah. And I think it's possible that you see a bit more in this film than you might otherwise have got on the telly.
Yeah.
So it may have a special place in his heart. But I don't think... The whole Barbara Bach in the bath scene is just gratuitous.
Yeah,
to my modern mind.
No, but there is no need for it. Absolutely none.
Sort of.
But I guess it's on that list with, like, you know, cable cars and.
Quite shocking to find in a film that I remember watching as an 8-year-old. I just don't know whether they would have cut that. I don't know whether that.
They must
have cut that for Saturday.
Yeah,
afternoon
I often
viewing.
Think there must have been cuts for Saturday afternoon.
Yeah. the other problematic moment, but at least it's within the film, is the bits where they're calling Carl Weathers Blackie.
Yeah.
At least that's sort of okay. Well, fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, they're nasty fascist partisans and they probably were a bit racist.
Yes.
You know, you feel like Carl Weathers is quite happy with those scenes.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm not completely convinced.
Yeah, agreed. You know, agreed.
Right. Yeah.
I think the language there is, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, it's coming from characters who are supposed to be a fascist militia. Yeah. I mean, you know, it could have been worse.
Probably they were not, you know, tremendously woke.
No, I'd imagine very unwoke.
The casualty list, you want to have a guess at the body count?
I remember when we did Guns of Navarone being surprised by the body count. I mean, is this higher or lower?
Lower, is it? Well, because they all get off the bridge.
Yes.
So with the Guns of Navarone, what does it is, you know, sort of 200 Germans are blown up with the guns.
Yes.
It's 79.
Still quite high.
It's still quite high, yeah. But, you know, I mean, sort of, it could have been worse.
Yeah, it could have been worse.
The Cooler King Award for the most gratuitous American character.
Is it Harrison Ford?
Well, I think it's between Harrison Ford and Carl Weathers.
Yeah, I mean, we could give a rare joint award in that neither of them is adding much to the plot. Neither of their characters make much sense. They are both American.
They're both clearly only there for box office reasons. Mm-hmm. He's brought his Sarge Award for Best Death. I have precisely one nomination, which is the decapitated German.
Yeah.
Which is also what the hell is that scene doing there? If I had seen that before, I have absolutely no memory of it. That's it.
But I guess it's another one that starts with the storyboards, isn't it? You know what I'm saying? It's sort of
clearly, obviously a dummy and everything, but it's really the only memorable sort of... Yeah. I mean, actually, when we did Guns of Navarone, we talked about the fact that in a commando movie, you know, half the team are going to get good deaths.
Yeah, that's the usual trope. Yeah.
But they don't. No. I mean, half the team
die.
A bunch of people
is that
never
the nature
met.
Of the stars you've assembled for this?
Yeah. Do you have a meme?
You could do the decapitation. I mean, I don't know when you'd use it, but
I don't. Well, also, I just don't. I think for it to be a meme at some level, somebody has to recognise it.
Yes, fair.
I don't think that there is anything from this film that you would recognise, even if you were to show me a clip from it tomorrow, that I would necessarily think. Yeah, if you showed me Harrison Ford in the pilot seat, I would assume it was an outtake from Star Wars or something.
Well, you know, or even an Indiana Jones movie. I mean,
I don't think there are really any stiff upper lips.
I noticed that
Robert Shaw's leg gets better, you know, when he has to... Actually, no, that's not true. That's not true. There is a stiff upper lip at the point at which they set the timer for 30 seconds.
Okay.
Because they think they're both going to die. They can have that. And that bit I did rather like.
Yeah.
You know. Won't have so far to run.
Yeah.
That was a nice line. The nastiest Nazi is obviously Lescavar.
Yes.
Who is a good baddie. He is a good baddie.
He is a good baddie. This film, actually, the baddies are a bit more interesting than the goodies in this film.
Yeah, but if you're Robert Shaw, if you're Mallory and you're convinced that he's a traitor and you've been convinced he's a traitor all the way through, why not at the moment at which it's you and your team and him on the way back from the sort of the jailbreak, just shoot him.
Well, yeah.
You know, just shoot him then.
Yeah, you're making the mistake of inserting logic into this plot, which we've established has no logic.
Loose lips. I only have one nomination, which is they're Germans. They're going to be punctual. when they're saying that scene, actually, all of that scene kind of works.
I mean, I quite like the discussion on blowing up the bridge. You know, the finest engineers of, it might be the best engineers. I'm the best at blowing stuff up. It's all right.
Yes, no, I mean, Edward Fox does quite well in this, actually. I've always felt like he was an actor who, was a little bit sort of trapped. He's very good in Day of the Jackal.
Yeah.
Then he plays Edward in Edward and Mrs. Simpson. And then basically it's sort of, he's kind of popping up in things of war movie foxes. I think we've agreed that his brother is better in King Rat.
Yes. But that's the interesting thing, is this is another film like King Rat, you know, adapted from a successful commercial novelist. Who's, you know, neither James Clavell nor Alistair MacLean any pretensions to be sort of a literary writer. They're both sort of writers of bestsellers. And yet, one of those films has a script and a plot which works, that feels like there's been a novelist involved.
Yeah.
This one really doesn't.
This one moves so far from the Alistair MacLean novel that Alistair MacLean apparently then rips the plot of this off for another novel.
Oh, there we go. There we go. It's quite different. Then,
I mean, although when I read the synopsis, because I have read the novel as a schoolboy, but the only thing I can remember is the sort of the beginning of it.
Yeah.
When I looked it up, I couldn't tell. It didn't look that different. The thing that absolutely had stayed with me for 40 years, and I don't think I had watched this between the ages of 8 and 49, was the blowing up the dam to knock down the bridge.
Yes.
Because I think that I know I watched this film with my dad, and my dad thought this was tremendously clever and was explaining it to me.
Yes.
And we both thought that's clever.
You do like a bit of physics.
We like engineering. We like engineering failures. Yeah. And Judgment at Nuremberg. Where are we on war crimes here? I sort of feel like the Chetniks were just offered as war criminals.
It's a nasty partisan war on both sides.
Obviously, sort of shooting a man without a court martial, it's very much a drumhead. Is it a drumhead court martial?
Very much frowned upon.
Yeah. Although that's what Churchill wanted to do at Nuremberg.
Yeah.
In fact, is just sort of read out the charges and shoot them all.
Yeah, Stalin wanted a process. You know, Stalin liked a show trial, I suppose.
Yes.
You know, there was a form on this.
There was better than this Radio 4 drama a couple of years ago about the run-up to Nuremberg, which I recommend people possibly instead of watching Forced Escape from Navarone. Duncan, is this the operation that changed the course of World War II?
No. Right. No. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It's like all of this sort of, you know, the partisan war, I mean, it does tie down a lot of German troops very usefully that then aren't in Italy or France
or on the Eastern Front.
Or on the Eastern Front, yeah. You know, it's very, it's a very useful, you know, for a comparatively cheap use of Western and Soviet resources, that, you know, it pays for itself. But no, it doesn't change the course of World War II.
Worth Dying For. How does this film stand up? I feel we sort of know both of our answers, so instead I'm going to leave you with a final Harrison Ford quote as he sort of wrestled with some of the choices he'd made in his life. It wasn't a bad film. There were honest people involved, and it was an honest effort. But it wasn't the right thing for me to do. Force 10 from Navarone. Thanks for listening. Next week, to coincide with the release of Ridley Scott's Napoleon, we're wheeling the big telly into the classroom and watching Waterloo.